Tonight, we want to see the plot to kill the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 23, verses 12 through 35. Now, you know, Paul was always getting into trouble wherever he went. And we see here no exception. And here we have a group of Jews that are trying to kill him. They have made a pact. We'll talk about it more in just a couple of minutes. But let's back up just a little bit and review where we are here in chapter 23. In the temple area at Jerusalem, there was a frenzied crowd of Jews who had been ready to whip the Apostle Paul to death based on false accusations. And we've talked about that. We're not going to get into it. The Roman army stationed in the Antonio Fortress, which was adjacent to the temple area, had intervened and had prevented the execution. Because of the wildness of the crowd, it was impossible for the commander, the chiliarch, or the commander, he was the main guy within that fortress. He couldn't determine what was going on, so he decided to bring Paul into the barracks to be questioned. And when Paul reached the stairs that led into the fortress, the crowd had become so out of control. I told you, Paul causing trouble wherever he was. The crowd had become so out of control that the soldiers had to carry Paul. Incredible if you think about it. At this point, Paul spoke to the commander, and he requested permission to say something. Again, this takes guts. You know, what we used to call intestinal fortitude or guts, Paul had it. Here they are trying to kill you. Paul says, could I talk to him for a minute? I don't think that would have been my first reaction, but it was Paul with his heart. And amazing man of God here, this apostle. So he requests permission to say something. He was given permission by the commander and began addressing the crowd from the stairs leading up to the fortress. And he addressed them in Aramaic, and that was the common language of the Hebrews of that day, and that helped to kind of quiet the crowds down a little bit because he was speaking their language, literally. In Paul's last statement to the crowd, in chapter 22, verse 21, Paul quotes what the Lord told him to do. And that is, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And the problem here was the fact that Paul preached that Jews and Gentiles were equal in Christ without the law of Moses and were not required to be circumcised. Well, because of this, once again, the crowd is whipped up into a frenzy because, you know, he's against Moses, he's against the law, he's speaking against the temple. I mean, this is the kinds of things that they were saying. And in chapter 22, verses 22 and 23, the Jews express their anger and they demand Paul's death. In verses 24 through 30, the captain prepares Paul to be whipped with not just any whip, but a cat of nine tails. This is the one that whipped our Lord Jesus Christ before his crucifixion. Some men could not make it through that whipping. It was so severe. And hopefully, through this cat of nine tails, he hoped to extract information from him. And after being stripped, he was tied up for whipping. Paul asks a question that immediately stops any further attempt to whip him. And the question is very simple. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Well, the answer is no, it was not. And we talked about that. In verse 26, the centurion in charge of the beating rushes to question the commander concerning why he is about to whip a Roman citizen. And the commander rushes to Paul to confirm the report. Paul does. At the end of chapter 22, Paul is sent to the Sanhedrin to try to work out the situation among the religious leadership. This is a religious issue. We're going to step out of it. Let's see if they can, you know, get some information from him and we can, you know, come to some kind of understanding of what's going on. Chapter 23 now, where we are now, chapter 23, verses 1 and 2, Paul presents his defense. He is struck in the mouth for so-called blasphemy, for claiming that he is an innocent man, not knowing that it was the high priest who ordered it, and it was, and he was, by the way, a very wicked man himself. And probably here, remember, this was a rush job. And so they were probably in their normal street clothes. They weren't in their, holy Sanhedrin garments here. So Paul probably had no idea who was talking to him. He didn't have the typical clothing on that you would have expected. And so he spoke up to this man and he said, God's going to strike you. And essentially, you're an empty hypocrite for doing this. And in verse 5, he's informed by the Sanhedrin, you don't talk this way. This is the high priest telling this. And so in verse 5, Paul admits his ignorance that this was the high priest, and he agreed it's a violation of the law in saying what he did. In verses 6 through 8, Paul changes his approach with the Sanhedrin, and it's a divide and conquer strategy. He now brings up the fact that he's a Pharisee. Right there, you're alienating a large section of the Sanhedrin, and you're getting half the Sanhedrin with you, okay? So he says, I am a Pharisee, and I believe in the resurrection. Oh, hot button issue. You see, because the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection, the Pharisees did. And of course, an argument ensues from that. Brilliant strategy to bring it up, and everything he said was legitimate. It's not like he's just inventing things to say. So he brings this up. I'm a Pharisee. I believe in the resurrection, knowing that the subject would be controversial and divide, and it would divide the Pharisees in the Sanhedrin who believed in the resurrection from the Sadducees who did not, and his tactic worked. In verses 9 and 10, there was a great uproar in the Sanhedrin. Then in verse 10, it says, the commander of the Antonio fortress was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So back into the barracks again with the apostle. According to verse 11, the following night, the Lord appears to Saul to give him some encouragement. And he says this, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. Isn't it great that at just the right time, and I know we don't have appearances of Jesus Christ, okay, I understand that. But isn't it great that at the right time, God provides encouragement during times of problems and trial? And he does. And here with the Apostle Paul, this isn't the first time this has happened. God is providing Paul with the assurance, it's going to be okay. You got more to do. Your life isn't over yet. It may seem like this is it, but your life isn't over. Remember what we talked about this morning, too, and that is that we are immortal until God calls us home. This is obvious with Paul. How many times should Paul have died by now in his life? I mean, we could go back in the book of Acts and name specific instances where, Paul, you ought to be dead by now, humanly speaking. But yet, again, God is sovereign. He's in control. Paul, you got more to do. And this is essentially what the Lord is saying to him. You have more to do. You have to witness for me at Rome also. And this brings us to our passage this afternoon, beginning in verse 12, where the Jews now are plotting a conspiracy against Paul in order to kill him. You know, if they can't get him anywhere else, let's kill him. Let's end his life. Let's begin looking then tonight at verses 12 through 35. And let's go ahead and just read verses 12 through 15, because here, first of all, we see the plot developed. Verses 12 through 15, the plot developed. When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Verse 15. Now, therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. Notice the word conspiracy is used. We hear that a lot in our culture today, don't we? This, that, a conspiracy. By the way, most of what's called a conspiracy seems like these days is just truth. conspiracy or a plot, all right? So the Jews formed a conspiracy. They formed a plot. They formed a scheme against the Apostle Paul. Greek word is used twice in Acts, this word conspiracy, and twice in the Greek New Testament too. And once refers to a disorderly mob. Remember Acts chapter 19, verse 40? It talks about a disorderly gathering. But here it clearly refers to a second meaning for the word, and that is the product of a clandestine gathering. So they gathered together in a clandestine way, secret way, and they plotted against Paul. They had the perfect plan. They were going to have call him back to the Sanhedrin once again. And then before he even got there, they were going to nab him. They were going to kill him. That was going to be the end of the Apostle Paul. Problem solved, right? God's sovereign. God's in control. And it says the Jews formed a conspiracy. Notice that the secular Roman government was fairer at this point to the Apostle Paul than the Jews and the religious leadership. His own people. They weren't kind to him at all. And it was the Roman government here who's fairer. Homer Kent incisively notes, they needed the complicity of the Sanhedrin to get Paul out in the open from Roman custody. Evidently, the conspirators knew how morally rotten their leaders were, or they would not have suggested such a scheme to them. Think about that. And they were, by the way. The high priest was a completely rotten individual. No wonder Paul later appealed to Caesar rather than appear before the Sanhedrin again. Chapter 25, verse 11. Good point by Homer Kent. So this vow that was made by this Jewish mob would obviously not be carried out, although vows were at this time taken very seriously. You know, people today make a vow and it's not a big deal. If I break it, big deal. But that was not the case. Jewish mentality of a vow was very serious. God even says it in the Old Testament. If you make a vow to the Lord that, you know, you need to keep it. And although vows were taken seriously according to the Mishnah and the Talmud, there were ways in which a person could be released from vows. So it wasn't absolute, okay? There were ways, you know, the Jewish law gave you an end around if you needed it. But most of the time, you make a vow to God, you keep it. And notice, sorry about that. It says they would... they bound themselves under an oath, verse 12, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. So, that's how soon they wanted it. That's how serious they were about this whole thing. There were more than 40. There were 40 of them. Imagine that. So they had a mob here, really, that was going to attack the Apostle Paul. And again, it says, it came to the chief priests and the elders. They were in on it. We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing till we've killed Paul. Notice the next verse. Now, therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you. In other words, to the hall of judgment, to the place where the Sanhedrin convened. Bring him down. Tell him, bring him down. You know, we want to talk to him a little more. Kind of make them think that, the Roman leadership, that maybe they were trying to work something out, that they wanted to extract a little information from Paul, that sort of thing. But again, this was all part of a plot to kill him. The Sanhedrin finally found an area in which they could agree with each other. We're going to exterminate Paul. Isn't that interesting? They couldn't agree on the resurrection. the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but they could agree on Paul. Let's get rid of him. Let's kill him. So they found an area in which they could agree. And once again, we see God is in control. Humanly speaking, this should have been the end of Paul. But God had other plans for him. God told him that in the last chapter. You gotta go to Rome. We're immortal until God calls us home. Paul would not die for 9 more years. And by the way, and that by Roman hands. But it would be 9 more years before Paul would die. And then we find in verses 16 through 22 the plot discovered. Let's look again, verse 16 through 22. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him and led him to the commander. That's the chiliarch. That's the guy who was in charge of the Antonio fortress. And said, "Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you." The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it that you have reported to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council," as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. "Oh, we want to ask a few more questions. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, "Tell no one that you have notified me of these things." Back to verse 16. The son of Paul's sister, in other words, Paul's nephew. Paul's nephew heard about their ambush. Now, this puts a lot of questions in our minds. I mean, it isn't like we know a lot about the Apostle Paul's family. We really don't. We know a few random facts, but nothing highly specific. But this is fascinating. This is Paul's nephew. So questions come to our mind, you know. How he heard? How did he hear? Well, we can only speculate. We don't know. And again, there's lots of questions here that we really can't answer. I've heard people, commentators, trying to speculate on some of these things, but we just don't know. Here's some of the questions. Did his sister and her son live in Jerusalem, or were they visiting? We don't know that, okay? Number two, was Paul's nephew studying there as Paul had done previously? Remember, Paul studied in Jerusalem. Maybe, is that something? Was he following in his uncle's footsteps with that? I mean, we don't know. Number three, was Paul's nephew a believer? We're not told that either, so we don't know. How did his nephew get this information about the plot against his uncle? Some people have said, well, you know, maybe he was a zealot and, you know, he was involved with some of this, but yet, you know, "You're not going to kill my uncle." I mean, we don't know that. Again, that is complete and total fabrication and speculation. We don't know. Is it possible? Well, of course it is, okay? But I highly doubt that. But anyhow, the last question, if Paul had relatives living in Jerusalem, why didn't he stay with them? I mean, you know, there are all sorts of questions we have here. But this is interesting anyhow. We hear about Paul's nephew. So he hears about it. And then the text says he came and entered the barracks and he told Paul. I've got to tell my uncle. I've heard this. And obviously he knew this was not just a rumor. I think he understood this was serious business. So somehow he had some connection where he could get that. It wasn't just, "I heard this story out on the street." He somehow knew what he was talking about, enough to convince Rome of this, enough to convince the Chiliarch, enough to convince the commander there in the fortress that this is serious business. So he came into the barracks where Paul was, told him, and then notice in verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions to him. So, all right, Paul's told. He calls one of the centurions. Remember, a centurion is in charge in essence, of 100 men, all right? So he's one of the leaders. Probably they had, you know, different centurions there within the barracks. And so Paul calls one of the, obviously he's not just going to call a soldier, he wants one of the individuals who was leading it. He calls one of the centurions to him, and he says, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. Notice he calls him a young man. Now this is another interesting thing about Paul's nephew. The Greek word here brings across another detail about Paul's nephew, and the same term is used of Paul in chapter 7 and verse 58. Look there for a minute. Chapter 7, we've seen it. Chapter 7, verse 58. Let's look there for a moment. Chapter 7 and verse 58. When they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him, and the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul. Same word, young man. Same Greek word. Interesting. All right. Notice chapter 20 and verse 9. The word is used again. Chapter 20 and verse 9. And there was a young man named Eutychus. Remember him? Oh boy, sleepy Eutychus, right? Sitting on the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep. And as Paul kept on talking, he was overcome by the sleep and fell down from the third floor and was picked up dead. A young man, same word, all right? So it's used twice before in the book of Acts. And generally, the word is used of an individual, a man who's in the prime of life, usually between 24 and 40 years old, okay? So specifically, this Greek word is generally used of a man between 24 and 40 years old. A synonym of the word is used in chapter 23 and verse 18. Again, this is for the same individual. Ask me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. Verse 22, it's a synonym, it's not the same word. So the commander let this young man go, instructing him. All right, so the word young man is used throughout the text. A little bit different word the second, third time, but again, he's called a young man. So we don't know precisely. Again, used a man 24 to 40 years old, yeah, probably. Could he have been a little younger? Maybe. I want you to notice that the Chiliarch took him by the hand. Now, a couple things you think of. Normally, when you take someone by the hand, you would think probably a much younger person. And, you know, if he were, could he be a little younger than 24? Could he be a late teens? I mean, it's possible. Generally speaking, the Greek word was between, 24 and 40 years old. I don't think he'd lead a 40-year-old man quite that way, but this is a very young man. And so he grabs him by the hand. And one of the reasons he grabs him by the hand, too, is he wants to take him privately to the side. He doesn't want everybody around him to hear what's going on. And so he grabs him, takes him to the side and talks to him that way. So was Paul's nephew a bit younger than we might suspect? Well, maybe, okay? And by this action, he's calming this young man's fear. He wants him to understand he's not in trouble, okay? And it ensures secrecy and confidentiality, and what Paul's nephew is about to tell the commander, I want to hear what you have to say. And at the end of, Paul's nephew spills the beans here, tells him what is going on, and the commander finally tells him, don't tell anyone that you've notified me about these things. The commander is protecting this Roman citizen, meaning the Apostle Paul, and he needed time to counteract this evil plot against Paul before Paul's enemies knew that they had been discovered by the Roman authorities. So he wanted to go against this. He wanted to counteract it. He wanted to save the life of a Roman citizen. You know, this guy could get in big trouble with Rome if they found out, oh, you let a Roman citizen die? You know, particularly if he knew about it. You let a Roman citizen die? This Chiliarch might have, you know, I think demotion would have been a good thing for him. I think it may have been much worse for this Chiliarch. He was in charge of the fortress there. I think he would be in real trouble had he allowed a Roman citizen to, you know, to be killed, to be assassinated like this. And then we find in verses 23 through 35, the plot deterred. Verse 23, and he called to him two of the centurions. All right, two centurions. Remember, a centurion is an individual who commanded 100 men. And here's what he says. Get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. Now, get this in mind. He doesn't want anything to happen to Paul. He could be in very big trouble. So he's going to do absolutely everything he can to make sure that he gets to a higher up in the Roman government, who happens to be the governor. He wants to make sure that he gets there safely as a Roman citizen. So he calls two of the centurions, and of course in charge of 100 men, prepare 200 men. Well, that makes sense, all right, 100 apiece. I want you to prepare 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night. That's 9 p.m., in other words, under the cover of darkness. And this is the third time Paul has to leave a city secretly under the cover of darkness. In 9:25, Paul left Damascus. In 17, verse 10, he secretly left Thessalonica. So this is not a new experience for the apostle. Once again, he's leaving at night. And then it says, so 9 o'clock, get ready, 200 soldiers ready by 9 p.m. to proceed to Caesarea. The port city was the Roman capital of Judea and was a far safer city from riots. Jerusalem was not. You're not going to have a Jewish riot in Caesarea. It was a Roman government city. So, you know, that was going to be much safer. And notice, along with the 200 men, it says 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. All right. So along with the 200 guys, along with the 200 troops, the 200 soldiers, now we have more, and it adds up to 470 men. Paul has 470 men who are going to take him a distance to make sure that he arrives at Caesarea safely. Commander Lysias, who is the Chiliarch there, we know his name, we've talked about this before, was taking no chances with Paul because he was a Roman citizen. And if Paul were killed under his watch, he's going to be blamed. So better to have overkill here, you know. And you got 40 Jewish people ready to ambush him? Yeah. You better have plenty of soldiers there. And they did. Notice verses 25 through 30. Verse 26. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form. And we'll see that in just a minute. So a letter would also accompany the Apostle Paul, and this was common. When a subordinate was transferring someone to a superior like Felix, there would be you'd have to explain, you know, why is he here? He can't just show up at your door, and, you know, you have to know what's going on. And so there was an introductory letter to explain what was going on. Felix was the governor of Judea, so he's definitely taken a step up here from just the commander of the fortress there in Jerusalem. And as Stanley Toussaint writes, the commander bent the truth in saying he rescued Paul. Look at this. Look at verses 25 through 30 here for just a minute. Verses 25 through 30. Let's look at verse 26, and here's the letter, okay? Claudius Lysias, okay, there's his full name, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. And by the way, this is typical way to for people to address each other back in this time. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Now, you're going to find out as we read through this, he's bending the truth a bit. Not so strange with government officials, okay? They don't want to get in trouble. So they're going to look at, I'm totally innocent in this. I'm doing this. I'm the noble one here, okay? I saved a Roman citizen. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing. By the way, do you read anything about him getting ready to whip him, stripping him down? That seems to be conveniently left out as well, doesn't it? And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing the accusers to bring charges against him before you. So, very interesting. So, this letter may have very well been related by Paul to Luke, so that Luke could write it down here in the book of Acts. And Paul probably heard it read when the soldiers arrived, and so they were able to, Luke was able to pen out exactly, and of course the inspiration of the Holy Spirit as well. We understand that. But humanly speaking, it was probably told to Luke, and so he by the Apostle Paul himself, and so it was written down what exactly was said here at this point. I think that's probably something that Paul would have kept in his memory very well. And he called to him two of the centurions, 200 soldiers. And then verse 29, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law. I found him to be accused over questions of their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. Verse 30. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So notice it says in verse 30, he instructed his accusers. Fruchtenbaum writes, because of the conspiracy against Paul, Lysias sent the apostle to Felix, charging his accusers also to go down to the proconsul and spell out their charges against Paul. His plan was to wait until Paul was safely out of Jerusalem, then tell the Sanhedrin that they would have to travel to Caesarea to explain their accusations against Paul before Felix. So he wanted him safely to arrive, and he wanted a delay, and then he would tell the Sanhedrin so that they could send who they will. And then notice in verse 31, so the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Antipatris was a city of some 35 to 40 miles from Jerusalem. And it was known as Aphek in the Old Testament. You've heard, in fact, when we've been in 1 Samuel, we've heard Aphek, that name. That's the same city, all right, in the Old Testament. And 35 to 40 miles, that is a long time. And this must have been a forced march before they arrived by the next day. So they are marching all night. They are, it's intense, because he wants to make sure Paul gets to where he intends him to be in Caesarea. So they bring him to Antipatris, okay? But the next day, verse 32, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks, all right? So now here, because of the danger of the Jews' ambush plot, from that stretch of road up to Antipas, it was very dangerous because it was in the mountains, okay? And very easy for people to be in the mountains and, you know, to jump out and ambush someone. So they wanted to make sure they had those 200 soldiers with them, along with the other ones. They wanted to make sure they had enough firepower, so to speak, as we'd call it today. They wanted to make sure, the Chiliarch wanted to make sure there was enough firepower here to protect the Apostle Paul. But now, you see, they were out of the mountains. And now when they got to Antipatris, and they were now in the coastal plain, where an ambush wasn't as easy. You know, when you're out on the coast, the coastal plain, there's nowhere to hide. So they could see you coming. So those 200 soldiers, 200 foot soldiers, then returned to Jerusalem at that point because it was now safer. But does that mean Apostle Paul has no protection? No, all right. There would still be 70 horsemen would deliver Paul 27 more miles to Caesarea. So they wanted to make sure he was going to get there safely. And then verse 33. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. Notice it says the governor. When they get Caesarea, the governor. Kent describes Governor Felix. Interesting character. There's so much I could say about him. Let me just read this summary. Antonius Felix was the brother of Paulus, the freedman, who was a favorite of Claudius. He was appointed procurator of Judea in AD 52, but had served before that in Samaria at the time of Cumanus. Both officially and personally, Felix was noted for his evil deeds. And he quotes someone here, Antonius Felix indulging, this is Tacitus, by the way, he quotes the historian, Antonius Felix indulging in every kind of barbarity and lust, exercised the power of the king in the spirit of a slave. This is how Tacitus described him. Not a nice guy. Evil. We look at these Roman authorities. They were absolutely evil, evil people. Verse 34, when he had read it, he asked from what province he was. Well, he's trying to confirm. He's a Roman citizen. Okay, what province are you from? And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, from Tarsus, okay, when he learned he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also. So we're going to wait for your accusers to arrive from Jerusalem. Of course, we know Paul had a head start. It was obvious they were going to do that so he wouldn't be killed. I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Herod's praetorium, in other words, he was detained temporarily in Herod's palace in Caesarea. And these palaces were protected by the praetorian guard. An elite guard. In fact, Philippians chapter 1, verse 13, Paul says that the gospel had reached the praetorian guard. So that it was an impressive thing. But anyhow, he was kept in Herod's praetorium during this time. Well, here we've seen the progression of the Apostle Paul. We have seen him going to be here before Felix. We have seen God preserve his life. We have seen that we are immortal until God calls us home. We've seen him even, God even came to him and assured him. Jesus came to him and assured him, you've got more to do, all right? You've got to come to Rome. You have a responsibility at Rome. You've got to stand for me in Rome. And indeed he did. And we'll continue seeing him before Felix next time. But folks, once again, as we emphasize this morning, and that is, as believers, those who know Jesus Christ, we are immortal until God calls us home. Paul could not be killed a day before what God had willed. He had a plan. God has a plan for each one of us. He has a will for each one of us. He has a ministry for each one of us. Let me ask you, are you fulfilling your ministry that God has given to you? Are you faithfully giving out the word of God to those who are lost? Are you faithfully living before the lost the right kind of life? We need to be more like the Apostle Paul. Boy, his courage, his faith. I I envy that about the Apostle Paul, because I look at my own life many times and I say, I don't have the kind of faith that Paul does, that's for sure. But what a godly man, what an example to each one of us that hopefully tonight as believers we can follow. And then number two, maybe you're here tonight and you've never come to know Jesus Christ as your Savior from sin. Well, that's the very first thing that needs to happen to you. Have you ever trusted Christ alone to save you from your sin? And if you've not done that, won't you do that right now? It's really very simple. You, number one, understand, yes, I'm a sinner. I can't save myself. I used to use the expression, you can't pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Well, we can't. You think about that picture, you can't do that. You probably try to jump and do it, but that's not really pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, is it? Folks, you can't save yourself. You can't do enough good works. Good works doesn't save you. It's only what Jesus did. By the way, if good works saved us, Jesus wasted his death on the cross. He wasted it. Why did he have to atone for us if I can earn it myself? Well, the fact is, none of us can earn our salvation. We have to depend on what he did for us. It's not what I do for him. It's what he did for me, and I need to trust in that. Have you done that today? If you haven't, Jesus Christ died, he was buried, he rose again for you so that you might be saved. If you've never been saved before, if you've never trusted Christ, won't you trust him right now as your Savior from sin?